Today, can Labour overcome its divisions to face down Britain's new Conservative Prime Minister? And as Boris Johnson carries out a brutal reshuffle of his cabinet, Sonia Soda on what we learned from his first Downing Street speech.
From now on, it is Jeremy Corbyn.
Jeremy Corbyn!
Versus Boris Johnson.
Mr. Boris Johnson!
But as Parliament breaks up for the summer, the Labour leader's ability to oppose his new Conservative rival has been hampered by deep divisions on his own side. He's faced anger over Brexit.
There is no jobs first Brexit. Brexit is at odds with Labour's internationalist values.
And fury over the handling of anti-Semitism.
Within the Labour Party, anti-Semitism is now more commonplace, it is more conspicuous, and it is more corrosive.
With some describing it as a civil war that pits the party leader against his deputy, Tom Watson. From The Guardian, I'm Anoushka Astana. Today in Focus, can the Labour Party reunite to oppose Boris Johnson? Heather Stewart, political editor of The Guardian, you spend a lot of time in Parliament. Take us up to Jeremy Corbyn's office.
Well, Jeremy Corbyn's quite a lucky man, really. He has a suite of offices. I think they're always allocated to the leader of the opposition party. And he has quite a nice, cosy office with lots of sort of photographs and, you know, pictures of him campaigning and artworks. And he has a beautiful view of the Thames and across the river. And outside of that is a much bigger office, sort of airy room, where a lot of his staff and advisers sit. Including his two sort of key lieutenants, really, I suppose you would say, Carrie Murphy and Seamus Milne.
And who are they?
The pair of them together are absolutely key to sort of helping to form Jeremy Corbyn's strategy and his relationships with the wider party, I think. Carrie Murphy is, she's quite a colourful character. She's a former nurse. I suppose she's Jeremy Corbyn's sort of gatekeeper, his enforcer. She has some of the difficult conversations, I think, that he doesn't like having. He's not someone who particularly likes conflict, doesn't like telling people off, doesn't like sacking people, doesn't like any of those things. She's the woman who's out there sort of managing the team, but also reaching out into the sort of shadow cabinet and the wider party and sometimes talking tough on behalf of the leader, I think.
And Seamus Milne?
Well, formerly of this parish, of course, used to be a Guardian journalist for many years. And he's fiercely bright, charming. He has quite left-wing views, as does Jeremy Corbyn, of course. And he sometimes features in sort of media coverage as this rather shadowy, mysterious figure who's a kind of puppet master for the Labour leader almost.
So inside the bustling office, how did they react to Boris Johnson's victory?
Well, I think it's double-edged for them. So they're quite pleased in the sense that, you know, Jeremy Corbyn likes to portray himself in an almost sort of populist way as being for the ordinary people and against the elite. And, you know, Boris Johnson, very easy to caricature. He's Etonian, he's posh, he's, you know, wanted to be prime minister since he was 5 or 6 or whatever. And he's quite easy for Labour to attack. It's quite easy to say this. He's a kind of exemplar of exactly the sort of system that we want to try and overthrow.
I stress, I don't believe that economic equality is possible. Indeed, some measure of inequality is essential for the spirit of envy and keeping up with the Joneses and so on. That is a valuable spur to economic activity.
On the other hand, I think Jeremy Corbyn was a brilliant candidate to run against Theresa May in the 2017 general election campaign because she's very wooden, she's not authentic, she's not comfortable in her own skin. Johnson is a very good campaigner, and that may prove more difficult for Jeremy Corbyn because being a campaigner is one of his strengths.
And so right now, when they turn their attention to their own party, to MPs, to peers, to members, what is the scene in front of them?
Well, it's very bitter. It's back to, I would say, the sort of toxic tone that we saw in the wake of the referendum in 2016 when there were mass resignations from the shadow cabinet. There is this sense, I think, in Lotto, as it's called, the leader of the opposition's office, that a lot of the wider parliamentary party would like to sort of overthrow Jeremy Corbyn, would like to shift the party back to a different bit of the political spectrum. And so I think there's a bit of a bunker mentality, I think it's fair to say.
We're going to Labour now. and civil war rips apart captive Corbyn's team.
In the media, people are describing this as civil war. I mean, is that what it looks like to them? And if so, who do they see as leading the revolt?
Well, they tend to see Tom Watson, who is, of course, Jeremy Corbyn's deputy.
Never exactly brothers in arms, the two men at the top of Labour have one thing in common. They were both elected to their posts. It means Tom Watson can't be sacked and can speak his mind.
I mean, he's long been a sort of pantomime villain almost for the left of the party. And, you know, whenever there's any shenanigans going on, the assumption is always that Tom Watson is behind it. But they certainly see quite a lot of what's been happening in recent days over the issue of anti-Semitism, over the issue of Brexit, as being in some way stirred up and stoked by him in order to dislodge Jeremy Corbyn from the leadership. And remember, you know, there was a leadership challenge, right, in 2016, and there was a coordinated effort to dislodge him. So it seemed like paranoia, but actually there's been quite good cause for it in the past.
Yeah, reason for paranoia. Yeah. But there is a shift among his big supporters as well. I mean, I saw some polling recently from YouGov of members that showed, you know, a huge plus 65 satisfaction rate back in 2018. And although the members still are more likely to say he's doing a good job than bad, that had really fallen to plus 9. Is there a cooling off, even from those who support him?
So I think what's probably done that is the Brexit issue, which cuts right across the sort of left-right divide. You know, so Jeremy Corbyn didn't go into politics to try and do Brexit or stop Brexit. It's not something he particularly wants to be spending his time talking about. He wants to transform the economy, and those are the issues that brought all those young members into the party. And of course, remember, members are extremely important. They get the choice between the candidates for leader. So they get the final decision about whether Jeremy Corbyn remains in his job. But I think many of those people are quite Remain-y, and the careful line that the party has towed over the last sort of 3 years since the referendum, I think, has probably alienated some of those people.
And giving more power to those members is incredibly important to Jeremy Corbyn. I mean, I remember being in his office with you when we were doing an interview, and he took us to the window and he looked over the river and he pointed out at the building where he said the campaign for Labour Party democracy was born. Those are Jeremy Corbyn's roots, aren't they? A campaign to give more voice to the members.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was the campaign of Tony Benn, who was one of his great political heroes, mentor almost for many years. And that's absolutely been part of his project, his handing more power back to the members. Although, interestingly, of course, the members are very clearly in a pro-Remain position and have been for some months. And it's taken the leadership, the front bench, quite a long time to edge towards that position. So that's sometimes made him look less in favour of party democracy than he's always seemed in the past.
And maybe because of that gap between the members and Corbyn, some of his allies are pretty cynical about Tom Watson's passionate Remain position. Do you think he believes in it?
I think he does believe in it. I think it's also an issue on which clearly, as we were saying, the Labour membership, who are crucial to determining who the party's leader is, feel very differently to Jeremy Corbyn and not in tune with Jeremy Corbyn. And so, you know, those around Jeremy see it as, or believe that Tom Watson is using this as a wedge, as a way of separating the membership from the leadership.
And to be clear, Tom Watson's position isn't just Remain in a referendum on a Tory Brexit. It's that Labour must simply be the party of Remain.
Yeah, and it's he's sort of done videos where he's set this position out with a sort of, you know, moving orchestral soundtrack.
Our future doesn't need to be Brexit. We can change the future.
Given speeches talking about, you know, Labour's values are Remain values. That's the kind of party that we are. And it's interesting because Tom Watson has to some extent stuck his neck out here. But there are others in the shadow cabinet. So we've mentioned Keir Starmer and Emily Thornberry similarly have been more vocally pro-Remain than Jeremy Corbyn has been able to.
And this is one position in which there has even been a divide between him and John McDonnell, who's based, you know, just a few yards down that corridor that you were describing to us at the beginning. I mean, is this the first sign of a kind of division at the top of the party?
Well, I think that's what's been really interesting about Brexit. It's caused huge schisms in both main parties, right? But it cuts across the traditional left-right divide.
And it's not just about pressure from within Labour that you've been outlining. It's also about pressure from the Lib Dems, for example, who have soared in the polls with a,
anti-Brexit strategy that it sounds like their new leader, Jo Swinson, is going to continue.
I will do whatever it takes to stop Brexit.
Maybe as a result of that, Labour has now shifted its position. What's happened?
Yeah, so there was a shadow cabinet meeting a couple of weeks ago that signed off on a new policy, which the party's been edging towards, I think, for quite some time. So in the wake of the European parliamentary elections, which was a terrible night for Labour, they've polled 14% of the vote, Jeremy Corbyn started to say that he would like to see a referendum on whatever Brexit deal we end up with.
I think we do have a responsibility to listen to what everyone has to say and ensure that there is an agreement made and that is then put to a public vote.
That policy's now been sort of formally cemented and they've taken the next step, which is to say in that referendum, should it be called in the next few months on a Boris Johnson deal, for example, we will campaign for Remain. And that felt like quite a big moment in terms of the sort of evolution of the party's policy over the last 3 years.
I mean, how hard was that to stomach for Jeremy Corbyn?
Well, it's hard to know, right? Because there has been an argument that Jeremy was ready to make this shift some time ago, but there were these advisers on the outside, Seamus and Carrie and others, who were resisting it very fiercely. And certainly Brexit had become an issue that divided Jeremy Corbyn's very, very close allies. So, you know, in his sort of inner circle, Diane Abbott and John McDonnell, who've been part of his political project for decades, were very keen to move faster on this and to move to that Remain position earlier and to sort of staunch the wound within the party and move on to those other issues they would rather talk about. But there are others who say it's absolutely Jeremy Corbyn himself. It's a nonsense to blame it on the advisers. It's him who, you know, has been, as you say, a lifelong Eurosceptic, never been keen on the project and actually would like Brexit to happen so that he can get on with talking about the issues he's really interested in.
But they have shifted. They have got to that position of a referendum on a Tory Brexit in which they'd campaign for Remain. Has that put this to bed for Labour?
No. So it's put it to bed for now because even those who were quite open and vociferous in wanting the party to shift. So, for example, the sort of young left-wing Labour MPs who formed this group, Love Socialism, Hate Brexit, you know, sort of supporters of Jeremy Corbyn who felt he was in the wrong place on this. This compromise has satisfied them for the moment, but it doesn't say anything about what Labour will do in a general election. And remember, a general election could come within months. It's quite likely to come within months. So there'll be another fight to come when the manifesto gets drawn up.
OK, so we've reached the summer for Labour with the Brexit headache slightly dimmed. But that's certainly not the only problem they're facing at the moment.
Tonight, eight former Labour insiders break their silence on Mr Corbyn's failure to drive out anti-Semitism.
The recent Panorama investigation into anti-Semitism in the party was really bad news for them. What has been their response?
Well, so going back to this idea of there being a kind of a bit of a feeling of a bunker mentality, Labour actually put out its response before the documentary even aired. And that was to directly attack the individuals who had been involved in making it. Some of their complaint was about sort of selective editing of emails and so on. And there was absolutely some truth in that, I think. The programme did very carefully edit emails and use little snippets of sentences and things in a way that was journalistically perhaps questionable, certainly an argument there. But the thing the Labour Party did was to make very personal attacks on these individuals, to say they had political and personal axes to grind and were trying to attack Jeremy Corbyn. And that provoked a real backlash among MPs who watched it, also among the trades unions who represent Labour staff, who felt, you know, personally attacking those people, many of whom, I mean, they gave testimony in it saying that they had sort of mental health issues as a result of working in there and how difficult it was and so on. And it grated a bit, I think. I mean, certainly those around Jeremy Corbyn still say these people all come from a particular bit of the party. You know, it's a kind of coordinated attempt to undermine Jeremy Corbyn. It came over as quite aggressive, I think.
Labour responded after the programme by saying the allegations came from disaffected former officials opposed to Mr Corbyn's leadership. Well, the whistleblowers alleged that Labour painted them as people who had falsely made malicious representations.
I mean, these were people talking about working conditions in the Labour Party.
And we found out that the Labour Party had used non-disclosure agreements and was threatening them for breaking them.
Yeah, indeed. And in fact, we know there's this formal statutory investigation going on by the Equality and Human Rights Commission at the moment. And they have said that they're going to use their statutory powers to sort of request that people give evidence. And one of the reasons for that, one of the explanations for that, is it then makes those NDAs, those non-disclosure agreements, null and void.
Now, to be fair to the leadership, they do accept there's a problem and this week have stepped up efforts to, for example, speed up expulsions. And they know the Equality and Human Rights Commission investigation is serious. But there has been this view that anti-Semitism has been weaponized as a way of beating Jeremy Corbyn. Do they still think that?
Yeah, I think they do. Nobody is saying it doesn't happen and it's not a problem at all. But there's certainly a feeling the issue has been weaponized, which you can say that's true to the extent that many of those who have spoken out very strongly about it are perhaps not from Jeremy Corbyn's wing of the party and they're critics of his leadership. But of course, the fact that something has been seized upon or weaponized doesn't mean it's not a problem.
And if we just look beyond the anti-Semitism crisis and the Brexit splits that are happening at the moment, there is still this underlying ideological divide between what you might call Corbynites on the left and the centrists on the other wing of the party. The left-wing pressure group Momentum may well have concerns with the leadership over both anti-Semitism and Brexit, but it is still supporting members who want to deselect anti-Corbyn MPs. What effect is that having on the party?
Well, the rules were changed at last year's party conference and it was made easier to have what's called a trigger ballot, where unless you secure the support of a certain proportion of your local membership and of your local trade union branches, there is then an open selection, which means that even if you've been the MP for 5, 10, 15 years, anyone locally can sign up and can stand against you and can seek to contest that seat. So it makes MPs have to spend quite a lot of time thinking about their local party membership, and it makes them think twice and look over their shoulder to their local membership when they're thinking about big political issues. And you might think that's a really good thing because that's the vibrant social movement that Jeremy Corbyn wants to turn the Labour Party into, but you only have to look across the aisle at the Tories, where you've got a membership choosing a leader who might be in a rather different bit of the political spectrum to the rest of the country, to see that handing more power to a party's membership can have unintended consequences.
And the Labour Party membership has changed dramatically. It has become massive. It has moved to the left. It's brought back in people who walked away under the Tony Blair years. That means the Labour Party in 2019 is completely different to the Labour Party of 10 years ago. And yet there are now these new divisions coming out. If there is a leadership battle, and it seems to me that a lot of people think that there might be, I mean, Corbyn's not a spring chicken, even if he doesn't go because of any of this controversy. Who are the kind of Labour MPs who think that they could be a future leader?
Well, there's quite a few of them.
Always.
I think on the left of the party, those people who often get talked about are Rebecca Long-Bailey, who's a close ally of the leadership. She was shuffled in instead of Emily Thornberry to stand in for Jeremy Corbyn in Prime Minister's Questions quite recently. That was seen as a sign they were getting her ready, potentially.
There is no evidence this government takes this seriously.
And was it a bit of a snub at Emily Thornberry?
Big snub, yeah, absolutely. Emily herself is one of those people, I think, who would be up for the job.
You know, we have a great deal in common. And the biggest thing that we have in common is that we are Labour.
So shadow business, shadow foreign, who
Keir
else?
Keir Starmer, I think, at some
shadow
point
Brexit,
might
okay
like to have a go.
I'm really pleased that whatever outcome the next Prime Minister puts before us, it must be subject to another referendum.
There's a lot of talk about whether John McDonnell himself, although he's not that much younger than Jeremy Corbyn, but there are some issues about whether, if it was felt there wasn't a left-wing candidate to whom the project could be handed over intact, perhaps John himself would be a natural caretaker leader.
Whenever we thought it was in the interest of the nation to do so, we've defeated the Tories.
Jess Phillips is another one. We constantly hear rumours she might be willing to challenge Jeremy Corbyn.
I thought I'd met posh people before I came here, but I'd actually just met people who eat olives.
Gosh, so Jeremy Corbyn's looking out at his top table and seeing quite a lot of people eyeing up his job.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's politics, right?
God. OK, now looking to the future, what did Jeremy Corbyn's biggest critics think is going to happen? How do they see this unfolding?
I think they hope that ultimately those members, even though many of them did come into the party energised by Jeremy Corbyn, by his campaign in 2017, for example, in the general election, I think they hope that some of those members drift away, perhaps, and are willing to be open-minded enough to consider a different kind of leader, not necessarily someone, on the right wing of the Labour Party or the very centre of the political spectrum. And indeed, some of those candidates, the Chucker and Munna and Chris Leslie, people we would have been talking about in this context not so long ago, have, of course, drifted away elsewhere. But, you know, I think the sort of Watsonites, if that's a thing, would like to see somebody a bit less left wing than Jeremy Corbyn and perhaps with a different leadership style taking over.
And what about Team Corbyn? I mean, what do they hope for?
Well, so those membership figures don't look as good as they did, but they don't yet suggest that this is a membership that are completely disenchanted and willing to sort of chuck Jeremy Corbyn over the side. So I think they hope and believe that it's possible to reunite and re-energise the party once the Brexit issue is dealt with.
And are they still up for the fight?
I think they are on those issues. I think the Brexit issue has been incredibly debilitating and difficult, and it's been quite wearing, I think, and it's not something Jeremy Corbyn has particularly enjoyed dealing with. I bumped into him in the glass atrium in Parliament, where there's a sort of coffee shop and other things, and MPs sort of hang about. And I bumped into him the day of that shadow cabinet meeting when they signed off on the Brexit compromise. And he was back to his sort of twinkly-eyed, cheerful self, chatting and patting people on the back and being very open in a way that I hadn't seen him for some weeks and months. So I think if they can get past this issue, they'll be in quite a good place. But, you know, as I say, this is a Brexit moment in British politics, isn't it? And you've got to plant your flag somewhere, and it's very hard to ignore.
Heather, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Heather Stewart, The Guardian's brilliant political editor. Follow her reporting at theguardian.com. Coming up, he's arrived.
I'm Emma John, and I'm sorry. I lied to you.
It's the spin!
I said we'd be happy if England won the World Cup, but lost the Ashes. It's not true. I want it all. I know it's greedy, but positioning the urn next to the World Cup on Ben Stokes' mantelpiece would make this the ultimate summer for English cricket. So join us on The Spin as we turn ourselves into emotional wrecks all over again. It couldn't be as nerve-wracking as the World Cup final, could it?
It's The Spin!
The Spin is supported by NatWest.
Now, we've had day one of Boris Johnson's premiership with a visit to the Queen, followed by a lot of sacked ministers. So what type of Prime Minister will he be? Guardian columnist and Observer chief leader writer Sonia Soda gives us her take on his first speech.
The new Prime Minister.
I have just been to see Her Majesty the Queen, who has invited me to form a government, and I have accepted.
Like many Westminster watchers, I've watched Boris Johnson give a number of speeches over the years, and for me, the speech he gave on the steps of Downing Street yesterday wasn't really up there. I think you can evaluate it in two ways. First of all, in terms of the tone, and secondly, in terms of the content. In terms of the tone of the speech, Boris Johnson used some very classic Boris Johnson language, the kind of language you might actually see a journalist using more than Britain's new Prime Minister. We heard him talk about, for example, the doubters, doomsters and gloomsters.
And so I am standing before you today to tell you, the British people, that those critics are wrong. The doubters, the doomsters, the gloomsters, they are going to get it wrong again.
That's not really the sort of the tone of gravitas that you might expect from a prime minister. We also heard him use words like lubricate, for example, which I saw a lot of followers on Twitter react quite negatively to.
That in the event of a no deal outcome, we will have that extra lubrication of the 39 billion pounds.
So in terms of tone, it seems like Boris Johnson couldn't just keep the classic Boris Johnson note out of the speech. Even more important than the tone, I think, was the content. And for me, there weren't really any great surprises there. It would have been really shocking, I think, if Boris Johnson had stood on the steps of Downing Street and said, forget do or die, actually. I might need a bit longer to deliver Brexit. And he didn't go quite as far as do or die, but he was pretty unambiguous. He said, no ifs, no buts. Britain is going to leave the European Union on the 31st of October. And I think he's really making himself a hostage to fortune on that point. The other area it's really important to look at of the speech, apart from Brexit, is domestic policy. Again, there weren't actually very many big surprises here. It's all stuff Boris Johnson had trailed in the leadership contest. Interesting, though, we thought we might get some detail on social care. Actually, all Boris Johnson did was say, I'm going to fix social care. I've got a plan for it. And he sort of stopped there. So quite similar to what he was saying in Brexit. It's kind of a bit like, I'm Boris Johnson. You need to trust me. And although he promised a bit more extra funding from schools, that has already been criticised by people in the education sector as going nowhere near far enough to plug the gap in schools funding that we've seen open up in recent months and years. Interestingly, given how long we know Boris Johnson has wanted to be Prime Minister, the speech didn't come across to me like it was incredibly well thought through, like it had been crafted over a period of months, perhaps when Boris Johnson was on the back benches planning his ascendancy to Downing Street. It did sort of feel a bit more muted to me, a bit more like maybe a last minute job. I do wonder how Boris Johnson will look back on this speech in kind of months to come. And I wonder, he's promised a lot with very little detail in the speech. And I do think he's going to come very seriously unstuck in the coming weeks when it turns out he can't get a deal with the EU. He can't get the deal that Theresa May negotiated with the EU, probably through Parliament. He's going to face all the same very troubling parliamentary arithmetic that Theresa May did. And I wonder if he will look back and just think, maybe I should have struck a different tone with my speech. I mean, that would not be a Boris Johnson speech to make at all. But I do wonder if he will look back one day and think, well, maybe if I'd set the tone slightly differently, things could have been different.
That was Sonia Soda. Do read her column on the website. That's it for today. My thanks to Heather Stewart and Sonia Soda. Today's episode was produced by David Waters and Rosie Gillett. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.